Mr. Ryman, good morning to you, and Ms. Klein, good morning to you. Do either counsel have any questions before we begin?
No, Your Honor.
With that, then, Mr. Ryman, you may proceed.
Thank you, Judge. I am Corey Ryman, Stewart County Public Defender. This case essentially involves, all that we're asking is that the prosecutor of state of Nebraska be held to the same standard that this court has asked defendants and defense counsel to be, you hold them to that standard of when.
So is there a difference between the state and or a defendant? Is there some difference in statute or some basis to treat them differently?
There is no statutory basis to treat them differently. And what we have here is this gentleman is charged with a host of sexual assault charges. They end up through the discovery process, depositions, the state offers him a child abuse charge, felony child abuse charge. And there's nothing in the charge that alleges any type of sexual offense. So he pleads to that.
Is there anything in the factual basis?
There was in the factual basis very heavily about him sexually molesting the children. So yes, there was in the factual basis.
Any objection to the factual basis, or does that matter?
He pled no contest, okay, as I recall. And I hate it when attorneys get up here and say I wasn't the counsel, but it was the commission back then. But the plea colloquy is in the Bill of Exceptions. But I don't think they took issue with that.
Before we move off the factual basis real quick, was there anything other than the sexual allegations that could have acted as the basis for the child abuse charge?
What I would say the count, sure, in the, well, not in the factual basis, because defense counsel, I don't believe, commented on that. If you read at the time of the sentencing colloquy with defense counsel, there is a very long discussion about why Mr. Sullivan did not commit these crimes, why he should not be sentenced as a sex offender, and that he accepted this plea because he's a habitual offender, it was in his best interest, and also he did place those children in a bad situation that did endanger their health for other reasons, and I believe including substance abuse by both parents. So they did find, yes, that he should have done a better job, and he acknowledged that. And that's why he took that plea. And then, so you go to sentencing, and if you look in the sentencing colloquy, like I said, is in there. And the Bill of Exceptions demonstrates that Judge Stecker read all the conditions of post-release supervision and then asks the prosecutor anything else. Ms. Passhold, who is a very experienced prosecutor, says no. And so he imposes the post-release supervision conditions, which is your standard conditions with three specific ones, the MRT, victim empathy, and other behavioral program. The state has the opportunity to say, no, we want the sex offender specific conditions there, and they do not ask for that.
Was that part of the plea agreement, that they not ask for it?
No, there was no agreement as to sentencing. And what I would note, it was not a sex offender registry offense that he pled to either. So Mr. Sullivan, who's been in county jail this entire time, goes and does his few months at the Bureau of Prisons, gets interviewed by this navigator, and boom, comes back with the whole range of standard post-release or probation conditions you would expect somebody who's convicted of a sex offense to be: the electronic monitoring, the no contact with anyone under the age of 18, we have access to all of your phones, all the stuff you'd expect, okay? And so they file this motion, and they want to add all of these conditions because this is a sex offense. Why is it a sex offense? Because we looked at the police reports, and the police reports tell us this was originally a sex offense. They don't care about the plea or anything like that. So there's no new material change here whatsoever. And if you look at Ms. Porter, now, Ms. Porter is the probation officer that came and was available to testify. So she's the one that's on the stand enduring our questions here. She didn't do the original pre-sentence report, and she didn't do the BOP with the post-release plan. She just tried to answer questions for both ends. But if you look on page 47 of that, of the transcript, there's a question asked of, so why do you want these modifications now?
You mean of the Bill of Exceptions?
Bill of Exceptions, I'm sorry, thank you. And she says, because the navigator looked at the police reports and saw that this was originally a sex offense, so therefore we add the sex offender conditions. That's how we do it. Well, you had that chance back at the original sentencing. You have a probation officer that knows what she's doing, that has experience. You have a prosecutor who's got as much experience as I have that was able to say, no, we need to have these sex offender conditions. And you have Judge Stecker who's been on the bench for years. And nobody did it. So now all of a sudden you want a second bite at the apple because your navigator went in there, looked at the file and said, oh, we have... this was originally a sex offense, so we're going to make this guy do all these conditions. Well, you could have done that at the time of the original sentencing, and nobody said anything. And so when I and so they file this motion under 2263, and so I start looking at the cases that define 2263, and it's usually a defendant asking for a modification on his probation or post-release supervision. And this court has indicated you have to have some type of material change, or at least new circumstances that would warrant that. There are no new circumstances here. Everything that they knew at the time of sentencing. And they just want a second bite at the apple to make this guy jump through these hoops at this point in time.
Nothing, so, oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Nothing from the time he was in prison, no treatment, no evaluations, no behavior.
Exhibit two is the post-release supervision plan. The only thing that, and we talked about that, there's nothing new in there. I mean, she interviewed the victims. The victims don't want him around. Okay, we knew that before. She interviewed Mr. Sullivan. Mr. Sullivan denies he did anything wrong. The only difference I saw is the Bureau of Prisons recommended that he obtain, or he go through the sex offender specific classes. Now,
you mean the Department of Corrections?
Yes, I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
Is that federal vernacular that you're
it
using?
Is. Okay. Yes, it is. I'm sorry.
That's all right.
When you look at Exhibit 2, there's no new facts in there. And in fact, it's verified but on page 47 of the Bill of Exceptions by Ms. Porter that this was all based upon the navigator getting the file and reading the police reports and seeing, oh, this was originally a sexual assault case, so therefore we're going to make him do the sexual assault charge.
So were the changes based on a statutory opportunity or a court rule opportunity, or what was the authority that the state and or the judge used?
2263, 29-2263, and this court's rule, I don't know if I have it handy,
1904.
Thank you. Yeah.
So did the court or did anybody distinguish between those two, because they don't appear to be exactly the same?
The court, I believe, relied, the county attorney and the court both cited this court's rule when you laid out how we're going to implement post-release supervision.
The heart of your argument, though, is that on the original sentencing, the defendant has an opportunity and, in fact, an obligation to appeal if he disagrees with the conditions that are imposed at that time.
Yes.
And you would argue that there is a similar obligation on the state under the excessively lenient statute to appeal at that time if they think conditions have been left out.
Not only to appeal, but to ask, to bring it up at that point in time. Because
to make the record and...
Because they had the opportunity to ask, and they didn't even ask. If I could, I'd like to reserve my last minute.
Thank you very much. Ms. Klein, good morning to you.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Mr. Chief Justice. I'm Kimberly Klein, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state in this matter. I think what happened here is really precisely what's contemplated by this Court's rule in 6-1904. They essentially have to, by statute, front-load terms of post-release supervision even though they don't really know what he's going to be doing while he's incarcerated. The reason we've got the review of the post-release supervision conditions close to the end of his incarceration is so that you can tailor them to what will be useful to him and what will most likely be calculated to reintegrate him into society.
Counsel, your opponent argues that there's nothing that occurred during that period of time between the original sentencing and while he was further evaluated by the Department of Corrections that suggested that additional conditions or terms were needed. They all related, he argues, to what was already in the record at the time of the original sentencing. Do you agree or disagree with that factual representation?
To a degree, I disagree with it, Your Honor. Part of the reason the conditions were sought to be modified is because the navigator essentially went beyond what the plea agreement was. It was felony child abuse.
All the materials relied upon by the navigator were in existence prior to the sentencing, correct?
That's my understanding, yes.
So in the sense that there's something that came out of behavior or evaluations or classes during the period of imprisonment, there's nothing in the record on that, is there?
Not to my recollection.
All right.
The navigator isn't the person who does the initial probation report. The navigator enters the picture at the time when
and
the...
Does that make a difference?
I think it does, because the navigator has a different, essentially, function than the probation officer does. The probation officer is setting up what the sentence will be. The navigator is setting up what the terms of post-release supervision when he's actually released ought to be.
Is there some problem with kind of double jeopardy problem here?
Oh, I wouldn't think so. He's not being punished twice. They are simply modifying terms and conditions of what his essentially probation will be once he is released from incarceration.
Can you do that? What's the authority to do that?
What is it? 2263 permits it, and this court's rule, I think, of 6-1904 also.
So 2263 seems to talk in terms of when someone is on probation, you can modify terms. So was this individual on probation, or is this individual, if you've got a term of post-release supervision, are you on probation the entire time during your prison term and everything?
No, probation is, you have incarceration, you have probation once you are released from incarceration. It's a sentence that, like that, is essentially a two-step process.
Did the court have authority then under 2263? Does not 2263 talk in terms of during the term of probation you can modify?
That's correct. And I think that's why mostly we rely on 6-1904, which is specific to post-release supervision and talks about what needs to happen, you know, 45 and 30 days prior to his release. And
how did we reconcile 6-1904 with 29-2263-3? Did we sort of reconcile those in the Dill opinion?
Well, I don't know that there's that much reconciliation that needs to occur, because 2263 is once he's on probation or post-release supervision, same really, and 1904 talks about essentially what happens to put him on post-release supervision, what you can do to tailor those conditions of the order upon his release, and then essentially after that, 2263 takes over.
Is the rule entirely consistent with the statute?
I have to say I didn't necessarily see any discrepancy.
Well, I think we said in Dill to some extent they're addressing variations in the course of release.
Yes. You said if the court modifies the post-release order, it has to do so prior to its anticipated date of release. And that is, I think, what 1904 is directed at. And once he is actually released, then you essentially rely on 2263.
I'm sorry, I interrupted somebody.
Jay, can you help me? This section 6-1904, does that have an internal reference to section 29-2263?
In part A, court shall specify on the record the conditions of post-release supervision may be modified or eliminated pursuant to 2263 sub 3. So yes, it does reference that. And to that extent, they are interrelated.
And doesn't one of the statutes also require that same announcement to be given?
Yes, I'm not sure which one it is, but I do recall coming across that. And he was, in fact, told that they could be modified at any point in time.
So I'm perhaps hearing two different things, and I don't want to mischaracterize what you're telling us, but I thought I understood your argument to say this isn't really a modification, a 29-2263 sub 3 modification at all. It's not modification because post-release supervision / probation hadn't started.
Correct.
It's something else.
Right.
And what's the statutory authority, not our rule, the statutory authority for modification during that period of time?
Yeah, I knew you were going to ask that. Let's see. I'm thinking it's 2262. I'd have to give it a more thorough read, but I think it relies on 2262.
Do you think there is one?
I would hope so.
If there isn't, do we perhaps have a problem?
I think you might. Okay, 2262 says when a court sentences an offender to probation, it needs to attach reasonable conditions, and it may require him to do...
Yeah, and that one's not specific to post-release supervision at all.
No, that's just probation, but if you look at the post-release supervision probation statutes, post-release supervision is a flavor of probation, so I would think that it would be encompassed within that statute as well. And so, yeah, 2262 is fairly empty. I think it's somewhere in 2262, I'll put it that way. What happened here is part of the reason that this came up is because of some internal, as the probation officer testified, the navigator went in and looked at this and said, because of our internal probation office rules, he can't sign up for just the regular crime victim empathy and the, MRT, I think, thing, because of the factual basis of what he's got. Our internal rules require that if he's going to do these things, he has to do them in a sex offender-specific status.
So, well, who's driving this? Excuse me.
It's the same question. What are these internal rules? Are they in the record?
No, they are not. We have her testimony that this is what the probation office rules and requirements are. And as who's driving this bus? Well, the statutes seem to give both the court and the defendant and the probation office all a key to the car, because any one of them can move to modify at basically any point in time. And so at this point in time, it's the probation office in the driver's seat, and that's how we got
so
to where we are.
So now we're back in the modification role?
No. I keep calling it a modification. It's a modification of the original. I'm not talking about a modification of probation. I'm not sure there's a better phrase for it. It's just a modification of the original PRS order. And so it's not a modification of probation itself. It's a modification of the original probation order, which they are entitled to do.
Before post-release supervision starts?
Yes. Yes, because...
I guess that takes us back to the question we were discussing earlier, but I'm not sure I ever heard the answer to it. Does the statute expressly authorize the court or probation or anybody to modify terms of post-release supervision after it has been imposed and before it begins, during that window?
No, I don't... specifically a statute that says you can do that. I don't recall that there is one. I think they were relying on this court's rule because it lists basically that 45 days prior to his release, the court's supposed to get the order, and within 30 days of his release, they can modify the terms of the original order.
Pursuant to a court rule.
Pursuant to a court rule, yes.
Where does public safety fit into all of this? Recognizing that the probation officer will have the legal duty to supervise this person while they're on post-release supervision, where does public safety enter into our analysis?
I think there's nothing in statutes that I recall that actually says anything about public safety. The probation officer took it into account. In her testimony, she said, a lot of times the victims are very concerned and uncomfortable with a person like not having a GPS monitor, and so that's frequently one of the terms we will impose as a result for basically public safety. Statutorily, specifically, I don't think there's anything that specifically references public safety.
Referring to our case law, is post-release a part of a sentence?
Yeah, I think it is, because it's a part of a probation, and if probation is part of the sentence, so you kind of have to mush them together, but yes, I think it is.
So what's your best argument why the state should not have been required to appeal from the original sentence as excessively lenient if indeed it wanted these conditions that were subsequently imposed?
Again, it goes back to there are multiple keys to the bus in this case. The probation office is who sought the actual modifications, not the state. And the probation office said the navigator sees that this is a sexually based offense, and based on our internal rules and regulations, this is what has to happen. And there's, I don't know what their internal rules and regulations are. I doubt that any prosecutor in the state knows what their internal rules and regulations are. So this thing was actually being driven by the probation office, not the state. And there's no way to know what their internal rules
so
and regulations are.
So does the state have some opportunity to either dismiss what the probation office has filed? Does the probation office file something with the court? Is this how this works?
I don't know that I can answer that. I don't see that the state has any authority to.
Does your office have some authority at this stage to say we're not going to defend this action?
I don't really think we do, Your Honor. It's the way I understand this to be written, it's that the probation office, the defendant, or the court on its own can ask to modify or seek to modify the rules and, you know, the requirements of the post-release supervision, and whoever does that basically starts the ball rolling, and I'm not sure that there's anybody I can't stop it when somebody else has started it. That's my understanding of how this works so far. And I know I'm over my time, but I'm going to take just a moment that has nothing to do with this case and thank this court, because this is my last argument before you after 33 and a half years. This is finally it. I appreciate your consideration and your probably indulgence sometimes with my arguments, and it's been an honor and a privilege to appear before you for all these years, and I thank you.
Thank you for your 33 and a half years.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much.
I find it distressing when people who appear to me to be younger than I am.
If we weren't in court, I'd say bless your nearsighted little heart.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. And do we have time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, 52
seconds. Mr. Ryan, I want to ask you right off that if indeed the state has to show some change of circumstances before the terms of supervised release could be implemented, what would the state have to show? What would the state's burden of proof be?
I believe they could do that with a thorough post-release supervision plan that demonstrated, I've met with this individual, here's the programming that he had, here's what the Department of Corrections was suggesting and the gaps that they have.
So would the burden of proof be preponderance of the evidence or beyond a reasonable doubt? Or
as a defense attorney, I'll say clear and convincing. I will agree, it's the state's burden at that point in time to show we need to come in and it's our burden to prove here's why, subsequent to the original sentencing, here's why we need to change this. So I do think it is the state's burden to prove that.
We just don't know what the burden would be.
As high as just you're willing to go. But a couple things real quick. There were some questions about gaps in statutory. I would note in State versus Dill, the court did a pretty good job, a real good job of trying to lay out how this post-release supervision works. And if you look at some of those footnotes from the court about amending the supervised release subsequent to sentencing, they're going back to you're citing the court's own rule, not the statute. So I do think there's a statutory gap and the court is attempting to fill in those holes with their rules and with their...
How does this come to be? Is it the probation, the navigator makes a recommendation to the state files the motion? Is it the navigator gives it to the judge looks at it, makes the call? How does this process work?
In this case, I can tell you the navigator filed the motion to modify with the court. And I believe that's in the record. And they cite 2263 on there. The county attorney then kicks rocks and says, gosh darn it, I have to go defend this in front of the right, and starts trying to get the probation officers to come defend what they want to change. So it was the state probation office that instigated this, and then the county attorney came in to defend it, I guess.
Your client has not in this appeal attack the validity of the rule that this court approved, right?
I think the rule and the case law defining 2263 are, I don't think they match up very well. I think they're in conflict because 2263...
That's not the question I asked. Okay. The question I asked is, you haven't attacked the rule, right?
No, I have not okay. Specifically.
And you haven't attacked the constitutionality of any of these schemes?
No, and I think, you know, when they drafted this post-release supervision, they attempted to basically cram in the post-release supervision into the probation statutes and said we want it monitored consistent with that. So,
and the definition of post-release supervision is probation. Is that correct?
Believe that's probably...
And a person on post-release is considered a probationer.
I do remember that part, yes.
So it is intended to fit within probation.
Yes.
By the definition set forth by the legislature.
Yes. And just the last thing I wanted to say is, I asked the probation officer, you guys are aware that there's sex offender specific type of conditions you can put on this. Her response was yes. And probation chose to not recommend that at the time of sentencing. That's correct. So they knew about it. They could have done it, and they chose not to at the time of the original sentencing. And the state is just asking for a second bite at the apple.
Well, the state could have asked for it even on its own.
Yes.
Or
yes.
The court could have
as well.
Done it on its own.
Yes.
At that point, your client would have a right to appeal based on the plea agreement, the charge actually convicted of, whatever basis.
Whether it was narrowly tailored type to the offense type of thing, yes.
So that's your strongest argument is there wasn't the opportunity to appeal. Now, let me back up. Those things weren't before the court, so he didn't know he should even appeal that issue.
Yes, I think your case law says a defendant has to bring that up at the initial point of sentencing, and I think that's what case law says, and I think the state should be held to the same standard.
We've said that in Dill or Paulson or
yes.
One of them.
Isn't this the problem that arises here is that essentially in any criminal case there's three entities. There's the defendant, there's the state, and then there's the court.
Yes.
And the probation is an arm of the court. And now the arm of the court is now coming up and making this request. Now the state, like you said, stepped in and said, okay, I'll give you the opportunity to, for the probation officer, I will ask, put him on the stand and allow the questions to be asked. But that's where a lot of this issue is arising, is that an arm of the court is acting almost as an advocate.
Yes, I would essentially agree with that. And then the state had to come in and advocate on behalf of the probation office. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. That concludes arguments in State v. Sullivan. Counsel, you are excused. And the court will go on to the next case of the day, which is State v. Garcia.